Ed Adams, and this is the Weekly Genealogy Toolkit, the podcast that helps the new genealogist get the most out of their research time and avoid the most common pitfalls. All the biggest events in our history are important in understanding how we have ended up where we are. But most of us don't lead the kind of lives that intersect regularly with events that will go down in history as being major. Most of our history isn't earth-shatteringly significant. But in its collective impact on people, I suspect it ends up being pretty darn important. A big part of what I enjoy about genealogy is discovering the small stories in history that are completely new to me, yet leave me wondering, how did I not know this before? So I wanted to start putting out an occasional special episode where I tell the story of one of those events as a means of highlighting the amazing stories that you may not be aware of, but also illustrate the importance of getting off the big genealogy sites and into the history of your ancestors' world. But now for the story hook. Have you ever been the victim of collective punishment? You know, you're on a group assignment and one of the students doesn't pull their own weight and the whole group ends up getting a poor grade because of it. I feel like this kind of thing has fallen out of fashion over the course of my lifetime, but I bet anyone listening to this has an experience like that. So, the Army has long been known to be particularly bad about collective punishment. I'll tell you, it's gotten worlds better over the years, but the reputation remains. I remember being at the Army's Airborne School at Fort Benning many, many years ago. We were all living in the barracks, and just as you might expect, there was a standard of cleanliness that the instructors expected from us. One of the bathrooms in one wing of the first floor didn't meet that standard on a Friday inspection. So rather than punishing everyone in that wing whose responsibility it was to clean that bathroom, the entire building was treated to a weekend-long barracks party. To translate, a barracks party involves much more mopping and scrubbing than I prefer in the parties that I go to. It sucked. And what made it so demoralizing was the fact that for 90% of the building, it was an unearned punishment. I think the psychology of the time was that in combat, you succeed or fail as a team, and the failure of one person can still mean the failure of a mission. So we all paid for it. So, yeah. We've all got that experience. That's what today's story is, except many times worse. I want to talk to you about the time that three entire companies of an Army infantry regiment were dishonorably discharged. We're talking 167 folks here. They couldn't possibly all have been guilty. But guilty of what? Well, that's what makes this story so interesting. I've often struggled with where to start when retelling historical events. Where does the story actually begin? Sometimes it's easy to say, but most of the time you end up in an endless death spiral of context building. I'll do my best and not start at the beginning, but I'll start at the point at which most of the contemporaries of this story would have become aware of a problem. It's an unseasonably cool summer night in South Texas. It's just before midnight on August 13th, 1906, and the last few folks in the town of Brownsville were closing up shop or were turning in for the night. The relative peace of the night was suddenly broken by the sound of rifle fire. 18 to 20 rifles it must have been. Bullets crisscrossed through homes, breaking windows, shattering lamps, putting holes into floors, walls, and ceilings. Not all of the bullets landed harmlessly, though. Frank Natus, a local bartender, was just out in the back alley of the bar closing things up for the evening when he was shot in the chest. He dropped to the ground dead. They shot and wounded a police lieutenant who'd responded to the sounds of the gunfire and killed his horse. The ruckus brought a few people to their windows, but it was hard to make out what was going on and who was doing what. The rifleman had shot out many of the street lamps, and as the lights turned on in homes, seemed to draw fire, so things remained dark. The rifleman slipped back into the darkness of the night, undetected. But everyone in the town knew, without a doubt, who they were. About 300 meters away inside Fort Brown, Major Charles W. Penrose, the commander of the fort, was laying in bed talking to his wife, just about to drift off to sleep, when he was jolted by the sound of 2 gunshots. As he flew out of bed and started putting on his uniform over his pajamas, he heard several more shots, much louder, much closer. Sounded like high-powered rifles, he thought, as he grabbed his pistol, heading for the front door of his quarters. Just as he grabbed for the front door, it swung open. One of his soldiers was standing in the doorway, visibly shaken. "They're shooting us up," the soldier said. "Go over to the guardhouse and tell the sergeant of the guard to sound call to arms," Penrose ordered, exiting his house and racing towards the line of barracks that ran adjacent to the exterior wall of the fort. B Company First Sergeant Mingo Sanders had just woken up from all the commotion when the call to arms sounded. His wife had woken him up, thinking that the gunshots were crackling from a fire. Once he had cleared his mind from the confusion of having been suddenly aroused and heard the buglers taking up the call to arms, he jumped out of bed and started throwing on his uniform, saying, "Why, that's not any fire!" Sanders finished dressing and then raced from his quarters, near the guardhouse, over to his company's barracks. As he passed by the C Company barracks, he saw a number of the soldiers starting to form up in front, still in their underwear. He heard an officer shouting, "Break open the rifle racks!" The men piled back into the barracks to break open the locked racks. In the confusion, no one could find the sergeant of the quarters who had the key. Sanders continued on to his company's barracks, where he found his soldiers piling out of their barracks in slightly better form and with their rifles. He ran inside the barracks to his office. He grabbed his gear, his rifle, and most importantly, his roster. As he got back outside where the soldiers were gathering, he grabbed a lantern from one of his sergeants and barked, "Fall in, B Company!" The soldiers instinctively came into their standard formation in front of the barracks, as if ready for reveille. The gunfire continued. One of his soldiers hit the dirt, taking cover. "Stand up! What's the matter with you?" Sanders ordered. "Get up and soldier. And if you get killed standing up in line." He began calling the roll with the confidence of a man who had been shot at several times before. With each name, a soldier in the formation replied, "Present," and came to the position of order arms. As Major Penrose raced from company to company, he ensured that each was assembling, had their leaders present, and was aware of his orders not to load their weapons. In fact, he threatened that he would shoot any man who loaded his weapon without being ordered to. He came upon some sentries and asked each what was going on, but no one had a good idea of what was happening. "They're shooting at us," was all anyone had to offer. But who was shooting at them, from where, and where were the bullets hitting? Unable to answer any of those questions, Penrose did what any army leader does when they get confused. He secured his position. He hustled back to B Company, where he found 1st Sergeant Sanders and their young, inexperienced commander, 2nd Lieutenant George C. Larson, just finishing up their roll call. He ordered Larson to take his company and form a skirmish line along the brick wall facing the town, from the entry gate to the north. He had C Company form up on B Company's right, continuing along past the wall, and then bending back towards the guardhouse. He then made it to D Company, commanded by Captain Samuel Lyon, and ordered him to have his company form up on B Company's left and anchor his left on the Rio Grande. While the companies moved out and formed their skirmish lines, the gunfire seemed to get more distant and finally cease. Penrose was talking with Captain Lyon about what might be going on when a runner delivered the message that everyone in the battalion was accounted for, except for 2 soldiers from C Company and the C Company commander. Penrose was worried. The C Company commander, Captain Macklin, was also that evening's officer of the guard. What if he and those missing soldiers had responded to the gunfire and gotten in trouble? He needed to know. Turning to Captain Lyon, he ordered him to take some men and make a patrol of the part of the city closest to the fort. While Lyon was out patrolling the town, Major Penrose double-checked the skirmish lines and continued to survey his men to see if anyone knew what was going on. After about an hour, Captain Lyon returned with his men and with the mayor of Brownsville. "Major," the mayor said, "one man has been killed and the chief of police has been wounded and his horse has been killed. And it's been done by your men." I want to pause here for a second and throw in some context. Brownsville, Texas is as far south in Texas as you can get before you end up in Mexico. The Mexican city of Matamoros is just on the other side of the Rio Grande that basically runs right through downtown Brownsville. It's also the location of historic Fort Brown, established back in 1845 as one of the first garrisons by the United States Army after Texas was annexed. In fact, it was originally named Fort Texas. It received the name Fort Brown after the death of Major Jacob Brown, the commander of the fort who was killed during the siege of Fort Texas during the Mexican-American War. It continued to be garrisoned off and on through the Civil War and after, and as we get into the early 20th century, it's once again becoming important to American national security because of the deteriorating political situation in Mexico that will eventually end up boiling over into the Mexican Revolution. The fort didn't look like what you're probably picturing in your mind. It wasn't your typical palisaded wooden frontier fort like you see in the old John Wayne flicks, and it didn't even have a wall all the way around it. It did have a low wall on the western side facing the town of Brownsville, and it had the Rio Grande forming a sort of southern barrier for the fort, but the north and the east were more or less open. A guardhouse in the northern part of the fort provided some security, and a lagoon made entry from the east somewhat challenging, but this wasn't exactly Fort Knox. Major Penrose and all of the other soldiers that I talked about as I was setting the scene just a moment ago were all part of the 25th Infantry Regiment. Many of the men in the regiment, including 1st Sergeant Mingo Sanders, had been with the regiment in Cuba at the Battle of El Caney, and in the Philippines where they took part in the assault on Mount Ariat. So, inasmuch as any regiment in the U.S. Army could have claimed to be combat tested, these men could claim it. In the late spring, early summer of 1906, the Army was reorganizing the garrisoning of troops throughout the continental United States in favor of fewer, larger encampments. As part of this reorganization, the 26th Infantry Regiment was moved from Fort Brown to Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio. The U.S. Army did not want to abandon Fort Brown, though, so the aforementioned 25th Infantry Regiment was moved from Niobrara, Nebraska, down to Brownsville. Now, the folks in small military towns can get pretty testy when things start changing drastically, but typically, as long as there isn't much net change in the population of a fort, townsfolk don't much mind. Their interest is typically economic, so the dollars coming out of one soldier's pocket are generally as good as the dollars coming out of another's. The problem is, the outgoing 26th Infantry Regiment was a white regiment, and the incoming 25th Regiment was a colored regiment. Now, from the outside, the town seemed only casually interested in this changing of regiments. Before their arrival at Fort Brown, they were hardly mentioned in the town's newspaper, and once they did arrive, the paper published only a few pieces. They introduced the white officers and ran an article chronicling the 25th's accomplishments at the Battle of El Caney. However, this outward appearance, as seen through the eyes of a newspaper reader, is deceptive. Senator Charles Culberson of Texas had protested the stationing of colored troops there, and the white officers of the regiment had heard rumors that the people of Brownsville were already preparing political maneuvers to stop their arrival. About a week or so after they arrived, things started going wrong. Two soldiers headed into town in their time off and happened upon a man speaking to two women along the boardwalk. As the soldiers passed, they opted to move towards the inside of the boardwalk so as to avoid the group and also to avoid stepping out in the street. Somehow, this offended the man so greatly that he removed a pistol from his coat and pistol-whipped one of them quite severely. In another instance, a private was returning from a day trip to Matamoros when one of the customs inspectors took a gold pen case off of him without giving him the ability to pay duties on it. When the private protested, the inspector said, N-words are getting too smart. The soldiers weren't allowed to drink in most of the bars in town and had to resort to sitting out back in makeshift outdoor beer gardens, and other stores refused to sell the soldiers anything from paper to medicine. Major Penrose had been made aware of the pistol-whipping incident and the theft of the pen case by the soldiers themselves. He seemed intent to investigate the situations, but saw them as isolated events, not as part of a line of events leading to something worse. Then, on the late afternoon of the 13th of April, the mayor and one of the local citizens, Lon Evans, came to post to see the major. Mr. Evans accused some of Penrose's soldiers of having assaulted his wife the previous evening. He said she'd been grabbed and dragged to the ground in her front yard, that God knows what their intent was should they not have run off when she started screaming. Penrose didn't think that sounded like something his soldiers would do, since he'd never had that kind of behavioral problem with them before, but he vowed he would investigate. He also decided to keep his men confined to the fort for the night. He sent out a patrol to round up any soldiers still in town, and canceled leave and pass for those who were scheduled to leave the post that night. He knew that Southerners could be exceedingly protective of their women, and that with the added racial dynamic, nothing good could come from having his soldiers in town with the people riled up about the assault of Mrs. Evans. It was late that night that the shooting started. The days that followed the shooting were hectic. Major Penrose found himself corresponding directly with the War Department, and the senators from Texas petitioned the Secretary of War, Howard Taft, to remove the 25th Infantry Regiment from Fort Brown immediately. On the 15th of August, Penrose received a telegraph from the Secretary of War's office, direct to him, ordering him to transmit his account of the situation that had already reached his office via Senators Culberson and Bailey. Now, I'm not entirely sure what the full chain of command was between Penrose and the Secretary of War, but rest assured, there were probably at least three levels of command who were getting bypassed as Taft's office was communicating directly with Penrose. I don't envy the poor major. The next day, a committee of local citizens that Major Penrose had invited to conduct their own investigation blasted a telegraph directly to the president's office with their findings. They, of course, incriminated the 25th Infantry Regiment. Later that day, Major Penrose replied to the Secretary of War with a fairly short response, indicating that an incident had occurred and that he was investigating. He opted for the shorter response, having already provided a lengthy evaluation of the situation to his direct commander the day before. Penrose was a wise army officer, but he was losing the war of the narrative. Over the next several days, Fort Brown went into a complete lockdown. No one was allowed in or out without Major Penrose's express permission. While Penrose and his officers conducted investigations, a flurry of telegraphs were zipping between the President's office and the War Department, and between the President's office and various notable citizens of Brownsville. Poor Penrose was too busy trying to figure out what had actually happened, and was only able to get out about one communication a day. At one point, the commanding officer of the Southwest Division of the Texas Department advised that he recommended abandoning Fort Brown and moving the 25th to Fort Reno, Texas. Politicians in D.C. became increasingly worried of an open conflict breaking out in the small South Texas town. By the early morning of the 25th of August, Penrose and his men were boarding the train to leave Fort Brown, and not even a month before they'd arrived. The War Department decided it would be best to move the 25th from Fort Brown while a formal investigation was conducted. They were replaced by white troops, while they were headed first to Fort Sam Houston and then on to Fort Reno. All the soldiers of B, C, and D Company 25th were kept in confinement, basically prisoners, in Fort Reno. For the next several months, the regiment was subject to investigation after investigation. First, Major Penrose and his men, then the Inspector General of the Southwest Division, and then finally the Inspector General of the Army. The President of the United States, Teddy Roosevelt, gave the Inspector General special instructions to let the men of the 25th know that if the guilty parties could not be determined, that all the enlisted members of all three companies from Fort Brown would be discharged without honor. Today we would call that undue command influence. Despite this apparent axe hanging over them, only one member of the regiment, First Sergeant Mingo Sanders, volunteered to even interview with the inspector. And that was only to offer exculpatory evidence for himself. After exhausting all avenues given, the inspector reported back to the military secretary that his recommendation was for the dishonorable discharge of B, C, and D companies. Bizarrely, he included this bit in his response, and I quote, "In making this recommendation, I recognize the fact that a number of men who have no direct knowledge as to the identity of the men of the 25th Infantry who actually fired the shots on the night of the 13th of August, 1906, will incur this extreme penalty." On November 9th, 1906, the President issued an order discharging, without honor, all of the enlisted men from the 25th Infantry Regiment who had been assigned to Fort Brown during the incident. A number of soldiers, First Sergeant Sanders included, spent years after the discharge trying to have their names cleared so that they could re-enlist. Sanders was, by some accounts, only months away from securing a lifelong pension then earned at 30 years of service. The vast majority of men who sought reenlistment would be strung along for years, only to be ultimately disappointed. Of the 167 men discharged, only 11 were eventually reenlisted into the Army. Major Penrose and the C Company commander, Captain Edgar Macklin, were both tried by court-martial, but both escaped with acquittals. Much of the testimony that was instrumental in securing their acquittals came from the very men who had been discharged without honor. The story for Penrose, Sanders, and the rest of the 25th more or less ends here. But the story that I want to tell keeps going. 30 years later, a young boy, about 5, was standing with his grandmother, just outside of a general store in a small southwest Georgia town. He was waiting for his grandfather to return when an elderly black man was struck and killed by a passing car only a few yards away from him. The boy's grandfather knew the man in passing and knew that he had been a soldier in the 25th Infantry Regiment, one of the men discharged over the affair in Brownsville. That young boy grew up and joined the Army. He served in Korea and Vietnam before finding himself in the Army's Equal Opportunity Office in the Pentagon in the early 70s. As if by pure coincidence, this young boy, turned senior Army officer, was tasked with investigating the Brownsville incident to determine the Army's response to a congressional bill in staffing that would overturn the 167 dishonorable discharges. A very, very long story short, in 1972, the discharges were recharacterized as honorable, and the sole surviving member of the discharged men, Dorsey Willis, was awarded a tax-free pension and received a personal apology from Major General DeWitt Smith, Jr., the Army's Deputy G1. So what does all this mean? Well, I think at the surface level, there's a pretty easy line to be drawn from the very beginnings of slavery to the Black Lives Matter movement today, and I'd say that this story fits somewhere along that line. But there's a lot going on here. At the end of the day, this is a big whodunit story, because even with the discharge of the soldiers, there's no satisfactory resolution to the question of who shot Frank Natus and the police lieutenant, Joe Dominguez. Discharging the soldiers was not about punishing those who were responsible for that crime. The discharge was considered to be the price for the conspiracy of silence that investigators believed was at play. And as repugnant as this kind of mass punishment is to the Western legal tradition, it was also the only surefire way to never find out who actually committed the crime. Army leaders and senior American politicians, all the way up to the President of the United States, felt that it was better to be seen doing something, however irrelevant it was, and perhaps do nothing and actually solve the crime. Let me elaborate, because as I say that, it doesn't quite sound right. Investigators believed that the soldiers were exhibiting one of the fundamental traits of the black race, namely silence in the face of questions from an outsider. Seems a pretty racist assumption, but it's 1906, so I'll let it slide. Let's say that's true. Let's assume that the majority of soldiers knew at least something about the plot to shoot up the town. And a smaller group may even have known a good bit. Is it a good idea to send all of those potential bits of evidence, spread by the four winds in an era where tracking down an individual in the lower class of society is virtually impossible? Doesn't sound like a good idea to me. The better idea to me would have been to deal with some short-term political fallout from failing to rapidly punish a crime, thereby building confidence among the guilty, and increasing the likelihood that information spillage would occur. This idea was even proposed by Major Penrose, but little was done with it. This all feels a bit like the carpet-bombing approach to prosecuting Al Capone on charges of tax evasion as opposed to murder. So they allowed the action bias to punish innocent soldiers in favor of letting the guilty get away. But were the soldiers even guilty of anything? Well, the evidence offers some pretty compelling arguments for yes and no. It was difficult trying to tell the story in a narrative way that I did because there's so much in the records of the investigations and court-martials that contradicts much of what I said. So as I encountered these contradictions, I did a combination of things. I went with what felt more likely to me, or I went with what helped produce a more internally consistent story. But I have no doubt that there may be major chunks of the story that I just told you that may not be 100% accurate. I thought about talking about the inconsistencies in the evidence and the testimony, and I thought about talking about the way that the investigations were conducted, and some of the interesting early forensic science brought to bear on the case, but none of it changed the fact that someone, or some people, murdered one man and wounded another and got away with it. I opted to omit it in favor of not recording a 2-hour-long episode, but if you've pressed me for my opinion, I would probably say that while there's some concerning evidence to the contrary, I don't believe that the soldiers of the 25th had anything to do with the shooting. In weighing the contradictions, I'm left with the general feeling that the dominant narrative of the time just doesn't make sense. If you'd like to dig more into this particular episode of history, there's really only two places that I'd send you. The first is to the University of North Texas Digital Library, link in the description. They hold many of the records of the investigations and the court-martial. There's probably close to 10,000 pages, and it's surprisingly riveting reading. The only other source I'd offer is a book entitled The Brownsville, Texas Incident of 1906 by Lieutenant Colonel Retired William Baker, who also happens to be the boy who saw one of the men of the 25th hit and killed by a car. So as I wrap up this episode, first I want you to imagine that you're working on your family history and discover that your ancestors served a few years in the Army. That's cool. But based on the years they served, it looks like they probably weren't involved in any major conflict, so you make a note of it in your family info sheets and move on. But imagine that it was the 25th that he served in, and imagine it was in 1906. And imagine if you had never looked into what history might be available for that unit. Second, I'd like to ask if you liked the episode. This is very different from my normal format, and I honestly like my normal format, but I wanted to explore looking at one of the areas of genealogy that gets me excited, learning about these sorts of microhistory stories. I wanted to share that excitement with you and hopefully get you excited to learn more as well. If you liked it, please let me know, and if you weren't a fan, that's okay. Let me know that as well. Feel free to reach out to me on Twitter at @thewgtpod or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.